Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay, your host every week, right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11 and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people in Santa Barbara at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets, and at Montecito's Upper Village. At Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Happy Monday, Neil. How are you today?
I'm doing good. How did you do this weekend? It was a busy weekend.
Viva la fiesta, right?
Yeah, I'm still quite in the dark. I've only been here 21 years, and I'm not sure what the fiesta actually is. But
you just missed your opportunity to learn about it.
I'm told that every 30 years you get an update, so I'm waiting.
It's like a reboot, a brain reboot.
Right, right.
Anywho, we have a guest with us today. We have Thomas Neches, who's the managing partner of Thomas Neches & Company, LLP. He provides accounting, financial, business valuations, and statistical analysis. And he also assists attorneys involved in litigation by being an expert witness. So, Thomas, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
So the first article today, I actually love the title, Investors Are Usually Wrong. I am one of them.
I thought when you said that the title was going to be, I'm not one of them.
No,
I loved it.
I am one of them. Forget about getting everything right. Most people are so consistently wrong that merely avoiding major errors is enough to set you apart from the pack. Over the past year, and for periods of 5, 10, 20, and 30 years, the average mutual fund investor has underperformed the markets for both stocks and bonds. That's an incredible statistic.
It is incredible, and it's true. And the problem is that in every calendar year, regardless if the S&P 500 closes up or down for the year, there is a red dot that is a negative red dot, meaning that it is underperforming. And inevitably, as humans, we have a really hard time not doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. So when the market starts dropping, most people's instincts, because we're ruled by fear and greed, are fearful, and therefore then they want to sell. And selling when the market's down is the exact wrong time to do it.
Richard Bernstein, the former chief investment strategist at Merrill Lynch, in this article, has a great quote. He said, "What's shocking is that simply by investing, most people actually made themselves poorer. They're just shooting themselves in the foot over and over." The reality is that if you just stayed put, whatever you did, you would do better.
And absolutely. And when you say whatever you did, meaning whatever you invested in, whether it be stocks, whether it be bonds, whether it be real estate, it doesn't matter. But the issue really is when you make big, bold moves. And so a lot of what my job is to help people prevent making mistakes, because oftentimes you get to a point where you can't afford to lose it all because you don't have enough time to recreate your wealth. And by not making mistakes, it's a major win in your financial situation.
I think the most important reason that everyone should have a financial advisor is that you need someone to slap you in the face and say, relax, it's okay. Don't sell.
No, I never slap people in the face, literally.
You did it to me once.
Well, besides you.
Oh, okay. And anyway, the Bernstein concludes by saying you really need to put the money in a lockbox of some sort and not give in to the temptation to do something that you think is smart that will probably turn out to be stupid.
Well, what I think is actually a better analysis of that is you need to work with somebody that helps you understand where you're at, why you're invested there, and to help you through the downturns. Inevitably, there are downturns. And oftentimes, if you are able to work with somebody that you have a good communication path, you're able to understand why now is not the time to sell, but rather now's the time to buy. And when the market's at an all-time high, it's not the time to not want to pay any taxes, but rather rebalance and make sure that you're doing the right things at the right time.
Well, this last point you made is really a good one, but you blew my connection, because I was going to use the last Bernstein quote, which he said, you need to put a
your money in a lockbox to segue into the next article.
Sorry.
That says the key to investing is to throw away the key and it's by Jason Zweig, our favorite commentator in the weekly Wall Street Journal, the weekend Wall Street Journal. And what he's talking about here is somebody is trying to come up with a solution to this problem. And there is a money manager that runs over $1 billion that is coming out with a new fund called Forever Fund. And the fund is unique in that it commits you to lock your money up for 10 years. And the reason to lock your money up is twofold. First is the promoter claims that by having a 10-year lock-in, the portfolio managers can choose stocks that have really long-term prospects that not that may not necessarily be going to be very well performing in a quarter, which he said is really, and I agree with that, really a very difficult way to make money. But the second reason is, and that's relevant to this discussion, is it forces you not to sell because you can't sell.
Right, so, and there are some products out there that do have a lock, you know, annuities come to mind.
Right.
The issue with most of those products are the internal expenses are just so great that they erode all, if not most, of your return.
In fact, that's what the article says. So the only way to do it is through annuities, if not for this fund, and it's just very expensive to invest in annuities.
Now, that said, I understand what that article is talking about in terms of the longer time horizon people have, the better in their mind emotionally being able to handle the ups and downs of the market. The reality is, though, is that if you are in a relationship with an advisor that helps you understand those market ups and downs and is there for you to communicate through those times, I always think liquidity or the ability to get out of an investment is the best way to go. Because there are times in life where you need to liquidate some of your money for whatever that is. Maybe you want to buy a retirement home, or maybe you're granddaughter is getting married and you're paying for the wedding. There are things that you want to be able to access your funds on.
But I think the reason you need a financial advisor is one of the things that causes people to not perform well is peer pressure. It's very difficult to be bearish on the market when everyone is at a cocktail party telling you how much money they made yesterday. And so with that sort of temptation, it's like going to your therapist to talk about how miserable you are is to go to your financial advisor and say, all my friends are telling me they're getting rich and I'm not, and the financial advisor could talk you off the cliff.
If I could add something at this point, if financial advisors or investment bankers are not particularly good at projecting the future for the next year or two, they're equally bad at not being able to project it for the next 10 years. So I personally would be very reluctant to lock my money in anywhere for 10 years because so much can change in 10 years. And maybe the person you've entrusted is good at predicting those changes, but more likely than not, he's no better than anyone else.
Yeah, predicting the future is a tough business.
Well, that's why I don't believe that anyone should be relying on someone who says that they can pick stocks. I think, you know, the reason I like index funds is that you can make a judgment that a particular country or our country has a secular growth rate that's going to be sustainable over a 30-year period. You invest in it and lose your password. And just
absolutely, and diversifying, because every sleeve or every different asset class has its day in the sun. Mm-hmm. And if you're diversified properly, you're capturing the upside of those markets.
Last article today is a statistic that should be of some concern to investors. And people can invest in what's called TIPS, which are treasury bills that are
Inflation protected.
And when TIPS have recently gone from a yield of 1.154% to 0.241%, basically zero yield, what that means in economic terms is that the real REAL, which is the real return, which is what investors need to induce them to give up their money and invest it, is only 0.25%. that typically means that the economy is in trouble. And so while people talk about low interest rates, if you look at the real rate versus the nominal rate, which is closer to 1.5%, and interest rates are going to be reduced probably again or were reduced again, look at this, and you have to consider the fact that things are not all so rosy.
Absolutely, and you know, last week was a big week in the numbers, and so we'll see that.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
And if you have any questions, you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. We'll be happy to answer those for you. So before the break, we talked about having Tom Neches, managing partner of Thomas Neches & Company, in studio with us to talk about forensic accounting, which doesn't get more exciting than that. So, Tom, you, thanks first for being here with us. You have a lot of letters after your name. Let's talk through some of those and your qualifications.
Well, I'm a certified public accountant, which most people know what that is. I'm also certified in financial forensics, which is a certification given by the AICPA, the regulatory body for accountants, saying that I have expertise in continuing ongoing training in testifying in court and doing forensic accounting in a court proceeding. So it basically says I'm an expert at being an expert.
Hey, that's a good designation.
I'm also a certified valuation analyst, which means I know how to value businesses. Similarly, I'm accredited in a business valuation, which is another AICPA accreditation for business valuation, which comes up a lot in damages in litigation, lost business value. And I am a certified fraud examiner, which comes up when there are indications of defalcation or fraud, and you need someone to look into where the money went.
So, gosh, these are...
Do you have expensive business cards? Do you need a bigger business card for all your initials?
I do get an extra long one in order to, you know, get them all to fit in.
So now, Tom, how did you get on this path to be a CPA and then a forensic accountant?
I stumbled into it. I never planned to be a CPA. I never really quite figured out what I wanted to do when I grow up, and I probably haven't figured it out yet. I was being a management consultant at Arthur Young & Company, which was one of the big accounting and consulting firms, and I got called in on a big Ponzi scheme fraud where investors were promised a 32% return interest because Jesus wanted them to have it.
Oh.
Well, of course, Jesus didn't want them to have it, and they didn't get it, and the money was stolen. And I was one of the people who was brought in to figure out, well, where did the money go, how much is left, and if there's any left over, how much do we give to the remaining victims? And I happen to have a lot of experience in databases, so I was brought in to do that. And I liked the whole litigation environment, so I went back to UCLA Extension to get my additional education for being a CPA, took the CPA exam, worked on a couple of audits, and became a CPA. And then I've been doing CPA-type work, and I got the other credentials ever since then, which was about 1989.
So, you know, as I was listening to you talk about how you kind of got your start in forensic accountancy, I couldn't help but think it was almost like a puzzle.
It is very much the question. One of the things that accountants like to do, and forensic accountants in particular like to do, is to create order out of chaos. You have all sorts of documents floating around, and you're trying to make sense out of them. You're trying to put them together and see what relates to what, and to tell a picture about what happened, and in many cases, what would have happened if the bad guy hadn't done whatever the bad guy did.
Interesting. So
is this as romantic as CSI on television?
Well, CSI, they tend to blur through the things where, for example, you've got paper that's been shredded and someone is meticulously putting the paper back together into pieces, and that part gets glossed over in the TV versions of it. Generally, however, you don't have TV series about accountants.
Generally.
I'm not aware of any. They have lawyers, you have doctors, you have firefighters, but I've never heard of a TV series about an accountant.
And on Broadway, there are very few musicals about accountants also.
I haven't seen one recently.
So typically, the people that hire you are attorneys
yes.
that are litigating or fighting about some issue or another. Now, is there ever an occasion when a layperson would have a reason to hire someone like yourself?
It occasionally happens that the person who's litigating turns out to be the one who's looking for the expert. So I got a call, for example, I got a call just earlier this morning about someone who's involved in a wrongful death case, and they're looking for a forensic accountant to do economic damages. But most of the time, the calls that I get are from attorneys who are looking for experts on behalf of their client. The attorneys know how to deal with experts. They know where to find them. And most of my business is repeat business from attorneys who have worked with me before and like what I've done.
Now, as I was on your website, I saw that you are an expert witness in many or several different types of litigations, whether it be, you know, lost profit, unjust enrichment, lost earnings, lost business value. How different, or patents and infringement, how different are each of those cases when you boil it down to the numbers? Are they virtually the same calculations of how to come up with what went wrong?
Well, no, each case is unique. But to some extent, you are doing, in broad strokes, the same kind of thing. You're trying to put together what actually happened. How much money did a company actually make or actually lose over time? And how much money do we now expect it to make? And you're comparing that to how much money a company would have made absent the wrongful act of the defendant. So I'm always projecting what we call the but-for world, but for the act of the defendant, what would the world have been like? And the advantage of what I do is that unlike real investment advisors, I can never be wrong because I'm right. always creating worlds that never were.
Right.
So all I can be at worst is unreasonable. So what I have to do is to be careful that when I'm making a projection of what would have happened, it has to make sense. It has to pass the smell test.
Absolutely. So now you've worked on a lot of cases, and you know, do you have a favorite case that you could share with us, and what those outcomes kind of looked like?
Well, one of my favorite cases was one back in the 90s I was retained on behalf of Danjack, which is the company that produces all the James Bond movies. And what had happened in the mid 90s is that MGM, who distributes the movies, got into financial difficulty and couldn't distribute a James Bond movie, so they missed their slot. James Bond movies have been coming out every 2 years, you know,
like clockwork.
And the one didn't come out, so Danjack sued MGM saying, hey, we would have made the movie, and we would have made a lot of money, and we want that money back from you. Now, normally, for a plaintiff to say, I would have made a movie, and the movie would have been profitable, is the absolute definition of speculation.
Right. Yeah.
You couldn't get across the courtroom with a claim like that normally. But what I did is I put together the financial results of all the previous, and then there had been about 18 or 19 James Bond movies, and put them all into the same time value of money so I could compare them and see, you know, how much money they made from the various levels of distribution, you know, starting with theatrical release, and then back then there was video, and then there's international release and syndication and networking and all that. So I gathered together all the information on the previous James Bond movies, and I found, although the numbers themselves are confidential, that making a James Bond movie is not unlike printing money.
Right.
That
it crosses all the generations. Everyone's watching it.
And each one has been financially
successful.
Successful in approximately the same amount. Some have been more successful than others, but they all have been successful. So I did an analysis, said, well, look, if this movie that wasn't made was just as successful as the least successful of the last 18 or 20 James Bond movies that had been made, this is how much money Dan Jack would have made. And the case settled on confidential terms, but the clients were very happy with the result. That's one of my favorite
Because that
cases.
Was reasonable. You took the least successful one, and that was your point, as opposed to saying it would have been three times as successful as that.
Yes. Almost always you want to be what we call conservative, which is to say if you're on the plaintiff's side, get a number that's lower than the absolute maximum. And if you're on the defense side, you get a number that's higher than the absolute minimum. Stay within the range of reasonableness. Stay within the range of common sense. You'll do better.
In order to do certain kinds of forensic analysis, you need information. If somebody is on the other side, like if you're looking at a hedge fund that is maybe defrauded its investors, how do you get all the information you need to do the analysis?
The attorneys get that information through what is called production. They make demands for documents, requests for documents, and then those documents must be produced to the attorneys, and then they then turn the documents over.
But how do they know that what they're getting is the real documents? I mean, isn't there, if you're dealing with fraud, isn't there sort of isn't part of the forensic accounting work is to find out if the documents are real?
It happens, but that hasn't come up particularly often. What typically happens is that they produce documents, and if we suspect that there's fraud, we compare the documents we have to the other documents that have been produced to see if they're inconsistent with what we would expect to see, in which case we mark that as an indicator of fraud.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we have Tom Netches, who's the managing partner of Thomas Netches & Company, forensic accountants, here in studio with us. And so now, Tom, before the break, we were talking about fraud. Now, how often do you come across a case where it's just downright fraud, like in Neil's hedge fund example?
Well, I would say it doesn't come up particularly often in my practice, although just recently I did a forensic accounting engagement that involved fraud. It was in a small company, the bookkeeper was writing checks to herself and padding checks for her paychecks with additional amounts and things like that. And I went through and documented all the amounts that had been improperly or unauthorized payments to her to put together a claim for fraud against this individual. So I have done that, but it doesn't come up that often in my particular practice.
And part of the business model, which we've learned about after the Madoff case, is that there's a whole business like Feinberg, who is a distributor of found money after a fraud. There's a whole business in how to equitably distribute money that is reclaimed from a fraud. And I guess some of the tools that they have are similar to the tools that you would do in forensic analysis to determine who should get what.
Yes, and in fact, that was my very first litigation services engagement, was the Ponzi scheme, very much like the Madoff case, only on a much smaller scale. Instead of being billions, there was $60 million that had been stolen, which was considered a significant amount back in the late 80s. And we were doing exactly that, trying to determine an equitable distribution to the remaining investors. We recovered a fairly large amount of the money. Almost $30 million was sitting in a pot available to send back to the various investors. And the question is, who should get what? And one of my jobs was to actually devise the equitable distribution plan where I sort of said, well, rather than giving them each a percentage of their percentage of the pot, let's fill up each of the individual victims' pot so that they all get the same. They all can get as much as the same amount. So that if some investors had already taken out money and were actually not as bad off as some of the more hurt investors, they didn't get anything in the equitable distribution. Whereas the ones who had left their money in and had gotten nothing back got more of a return than they otherwise would.
What I didn't realize is with a Ponzi scheme, if you just happened to get your money out before the Ponzi scheme went belly up and you made money, they come after you to reclaim your gains during that period of time.
That can happen. A lot of it depends on whether you, and it gets into legal issues that are beyond my purview, as to whether you knew that you were getting into a Ponzi scheme or not. And in fact, there are investors who deliberately invest in Ponzi, what they know are Ponzi schemes, in order to get their big returns out early and move on.
And those people, I think, should have to pay back their returns. But in the Bernie Madoff case, I've come across several people who, you know, took their money out just happenstance, you know, they didn't know, and they're being asked to write a big check back to the victim recovery.
Yeah, for the same reason. It's the most equitable that everybody gets back approximately the same percentage of what they put in, and if you've already taken out more, you're asked sometimes to contribute to that pool.
I'm not sure this is true, but I understand the latest reports is that just about every individual investor in Madoff will get their money back. Now, it took, 12 years and a lot of aggravation, but it's really amazing. They were able to really go after some institutions that maybe weren't as involved as they thought, but they had deep pockets. And, you know, Morgan had to pay a lot of money just because they were Madoff's bankers.
And I hadn't heard that, and that's very interesting because we got the investors back about 25 cents on the dollar, which was considered an extremely good result back then. And if you're saying that Madoff's victims are getting back 100 cents on the dollar.
Well, because they had feeder funds that were fat cats and banks that were also used as a source of money, whereas your guy may have just been operating on his own.
Yes, he was. I can tell you that as a general rule, if you want to operate a Ponzi scheme and get away with it, you should take the get away with it.
But tips on how to do a Ponzi scheme.
Basically, you want to divide your money and the money that you've stolen in thirds. A third you spend on prostitutes and yachts and all the other fun stuff that you did this for in the first place. A third you give back to the government in order to indicate that you've been cooperative. A third you hide somewhere offshore so that when you get out of jail, you can spend that money.
Well, okay, I have another theory, which is if Madoff in 2008 would have said instead of being up 12%, he was down 50%, which is what a lot of funds were, he could have said, I really failed, but he would have been able to get rid of 50% of his liabilities. He should have been intelligent enough to take the opportunity of a stock market crash to get rid of most of his gains.
Well, we can all agree that there's a lot of things Bernie Madoff should have done differently.
Yeah, like not gotten himself in there.
Well, also, you say how to get away with a Ponzi scheme. I'm not sure you could ever get away with a Ponzi scheme. It just, it's like musical chairs. At some point, the music stops.
Well, why you said keep a third offshore, so when you get out of jail eventually.
Yeah, basically, I was being somewhat facetious, but that's what I've seen happen. And you have to be careful about that because the fraudster will get better treatment if he seems to be cooperative and seems to be giving the money back.
Yeah, don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah, don't try this at home. Ponzi schemes are not the way to go, that's for sure. So when you're valuing different types of losses, oftentimes, people will see as they look at valuation reports a line item called goodwill. And most people always ask, so what is goodwill and how do you actually come up with that line item when you're looking at a business?
Well, it's an interesting thing about goodwill. Goodwill only appears on the balance sheet of a company if that company has purchased some other company and paid more for that company than the value of that company's that was acquired net tangible assets. So if you buy a company for, say, $1 million and you look at what you're buying and most of it is the ongoing business and there's not too much net tangible assets. They have some equipment. They maybe have some inventory, and it adds up to $200,000 worth of net tangible assets. What you will do when you acquire that company is that you will show $200,000 on your bank, on your balance sheet as assets, and the other $800,000 that you spent shows up as goodwill on your balance sheet. So that's how it appears on the balance sheet in the first place.
Interesting. And I think that that's a great point, because a lot of people miss that, and they always are looking at it and saying, what is goodwill after all?
Actually, goodwill is generally totally misunderstood. If you go onto look at a balance sheet of a company, and you see that a company has goodwill, it has nothing to do with the goodwill value of that company itself. Companies are often worth far more than their net tangible assets. They have buildings, they have land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the company, because it has the opportunity to make more money, is worth more than just their net tangible assets. That can be considered the goodwill of the company. But that amount is never found on the balance sheet of the company itself. It's only found on the balance sheet of a company when it has acquired some other company.
I don't know if you're familiar with this, but I had an article a few weeks ago about the proposed Deutsche Bank takeover by Commerce Bank, where it would have been one of the first times they were going to be in a position to acquire badwill, it was called, because they were paying a price below what the assets were worth, and as a result, they were going to be able to create a large tax loss, because they would be able to write up the negative goodwill. I've never heard of that before, but that was one of the attractions for them to buy Deutsche Bank, which the deal fell through, but it would have been interesting.
Yeah, I haven't heard of badwill, but one thing about tax accountants and tax attorneys is that they are infinitely creative.
Yes.
In coming up with new ways to try and not pay taxes.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks could only dream about.
So, Tom, you know, with the new tax laws that have been enacted in 2018, how have you seen, if at all, them affect your business and how you do forensic accounting?
Actually, not very much, because, with one exception. But generally, when I do damages analysis, I'm doing them pre-tax. And the reason is that when a plaintiff is awarded damages, the plaintiff then has to pay taxes on those damages. So you don't adjust down for taxes and then award them to the plaintiff. You award the amount before taxes to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff then will pay taxes on it. So that can be interesting in the sense that the taxes typically are awarded based on the kind of judgment award it was. So that if the judgment was a loss of business value, that would typically be taxed at a capital gains rate. Whereas if the loss was a loss of income, then that would be taxed at a higher ordinary earnings rate. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when you're trying to assemble a damages claim, you might have an incentive to do a lost business value analysis rather than a future lost profits analysis.
To capture that lower tax.
Yes, I could go with that. Now, on the other hand, when you're valuing businesses, C-Corps are pay tax. And now all of a sudden, C corps are paying a lot less tax than they used to pay.
Roughly 21% less.
Yeah. So theoretically, C corps are automatically now much more valuable than they used to be, because people would be willing to buy more because they get a larger slice of the pie going in. So you have to be careful when valuing a business to take into consideration this new tax law. And you also have to make some projections as to whether that tax law will still be in existence 5 years from now or 10 years from now, which is anybody's guess, I think.
Right, because in theory, the individual tax rates will revert back, but the corporate tax rate should stay constant unless there's another act by Congress.
Correct.
Do you have any protection, professional liability insurance? Let me give you an example. I'm sure it never happened to you, but in your business, you make a very detailed presentation in court, and the other side rips it up, and as a result, your client loses. Is there exposure to you?
Well, it's never happened, and in fact, I'd sort of announce to the world that I don't have professional liability insurance, because it's very difficult if you're being careful to commit professional malpractice, being an expert witness. You would really have to screw up mightily, and then you would have to, the plaintiff who would be suing you would have to show that if you hadn't made this mistake, the jury would have done something completely different from what the jury actually did. And since presumably that mistake would have been found out in court, the jury had the information as to what the right result should be, and the jury would have acted on that. So it's difficult to say that how you can mess up in a way that actually caused your client to lose money.
That makes sense. I see what you mean on that. So when you are an expert witness, what percentage of the cases would you say settle out of court as opposed to go to trial?
90% of cases settle out of court. I was working this morning. I'm scheduled to testify in three different cases this week, which is very unusual. I usually testify in three or four cases in an entire year. One of them, I was working on my direct testimony outline this morning. The trial had started today, and I got a call from the attorney and said, put down your pencil, we've settled. That's a fairly common occurrence.
Does it usually go until the last minute like this one?
Yes, because the reality is that as you get closer to trial, a few things are happening. One is you finally have all the information in front of you. You really know how strong your case is and how strong the opponent's side case is. Also, you're really facing the risk of letting 6 or 12 people who couldn't get out of jury duty decide your fate.
Right.
Most people, let me put it this way. I have a general saying, if a case actually goes to trial, usually one side or the other or both is insane.
And also, I think insurance companies generally take the view that the longer they keep the money, the better return they have. Why give the money up? But when it comes to the trial, they're going to lose the money anyway. So there's no more incentive to stall. I know that's true in trip and fall cases or things where, they'll delay, but at the end of the day, they're probably better off settling. But the reason that they don't settle is not that they don't have the information. It's just they want to keep the money as long as they can.
Well, it's always true with the time value of money. The longer you can hang on to the money, the more money you make from it.
Right.
Which, back to the Ponzi scheme, that brings up a very good point. Even though all the Madoff people you had mentioned, you think you're not sure if it's true, but that they're going to be made whole. That said, though, 10, 12 years of litigation, time value of money, they've lost quite a bit.
Well, if someone put in $1 million and then 10 years later got back $1 million, they've lost 10 years' earnings on $1 million.
Which is the stock market's up three times since
right.
The bottom.
Right, exactly.
So, in the stock market, they would have had a lot more than $1 million.
Absolutely. So it's great that they're getting their money back, but I'm sure they're still not feeling completely happy with that.
I'm still dubious. And I'll research it when I get back to my office. I'll be surprised if they really did get 100 cents on their dollar, but it may well be true. I just would be surprised.
Well, by the way, one of the reasons that they said is because a lot of the investors were these feeder funds, and they were excluded from the settlement. So it's not that every dollar
that
gets returned. This is for the quote unquote innocent investor.
Oh, well.
Oh, for the individual investor.
An innocent investor.
Well, for their sake, I hope it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, because, gosh, they really got taken for a ride there, for sure. Yeah. Although, I always say to people, if it seems too good to be true, it usually is.
Yeah, in fact, as they say, when you look at the Madoff deal, it was obvious that it was a Ponzi scheme before it was uncovered, simply by the fact that no firm could possibly regularly make 12% return on their money year after year. It just never happens.
No.
But that's why if you invest in anything, you should always have a custodian. The other problem is that not only did his accounting firm was three guys in a storefront, but there was no custodian. He kept the money, which meant he could create phony reports. You should have an investor and a custodian, which is separate. So you get two statements, one, the investment advisor, and two, the person holding the money. And people were willing to do that without having that second.
Absolutely. You should always have a custodian be a secondary level of reporting for you that does the 1099s, that does that bookkeeping functionality.
Yes, I mean, it was suspicious that the auditor of the Madoff Corporation, whatever it was called, was this
guy in New Jersey.
You know, who no one ever heard of and obviously didn't do any work.
Right, absolutely. So now tell us another one of your best cases or one that you think is most notable and fun to hear about. Because forensic accounting, I like to demystify it and turn it into fun.
Well, the entertainment cases are always the most sexy, if you will. I had a case in which I had to value the rock group Guns N' Roses. Hmm. Their drummer, Steve Adler, had been kicked out of the band because he was using too much heroin. Even for the other
even for the
members.
Rest of the band.
And the problem is just after he left, the band released their double album, Lose Your Illusions, which was then one of the most successful albums ever. And Adler was claiming that he was entitled to his share of the profits on that album. And I was basically valuing the business, saying, well, back when he was left, no one could have known how successful the new release would have been. And once again, the case settled before it went to the jury.
And so, so how does that work? Because technically, he was on the album, correct?
I honestly don't know if he was or not, but I think
he had to at least been on some pieces of that album.
I expect so.
Or wrote some of the album. So
we had a one of their records. Now we'd use that to play us out of the segment, but we don't. So I'll just say you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Tom, as a forensic accountant, you primarily work with civil cases as opposed to criminal cases, right?
That's correct.
And so why did you make that choice? Did you make that choice actively, or was it just something that kind of the way your practice evolved?
It was mostly the way my practice evolved. I was dealing with business litigation, civil litigation. So there was a criminal case that came up in along with a Ponzi scheme that we talked about previously. But generally, most of my cases are one company is suing another company in a civil environment. There's more money at stake in real business litigation than in most criminal cases.
And would you say it's true that the concept of forensic accounting is expensive is true?
Yes, it is. It takes a lot of time. One of the problems is that you're suspecting fraud and you can't rely on the financial statements of the company, you have to go back and recreate from scratch the operations of the country, which means going back to individual invoices, individual receipts, individual payments, and painstakingly put it all together to see how much money went in and how much money went out and what it was for and when it happened. And that just takes time, and time is money.
So if I look at this business as I would CSI, as a romantic business, you get up in court, you get to talk, you get to be an expert. You got to remember that a good part of the work is really tedious. Is that not true?
It's some of it is tedious, but the interesting thing is that most of it is actually kind of interesting, because what we're doing, as we were talking before, is we're solving a puzzle. We're putting back together the pieces of something in a way that fits and makes sense. So there's an intellectual challenge and an intellectual reward in finally making things fit together, finally making sense out of things. So it can be tedious. Fortunately, if the stuff is really tedious, I can assign one of my associates to do that part of it, and then I just get the results of that. So, for example, you know, if we have tax returns that have to be summarized, I have a case involving a wrongful death case in which the individual owned more than 70 properties, commercial real estate properties, and each one had its own individual tax return, and each individual tax return for each individual year had to be summarized and put into a spreadsheet so that we could analyze it and to see what the trends were. And fortunately for me, I have a fine associate who was the one actually looking at the tax returns and typing the numbers into Excel spreadsheets.
And I noticed he wasn't here on the radio show today. thank you so much, Thomas, for being here. And best of luck on all your cases, although it looks like most of them settle because they're probably afraid to go against you.
I hope so.
And thank you for listening to Money Talk on AM 1290. And we'll see you next week.